Okay, thank you, Debbie. I'm going to open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing on Wednesday, March 27th, 2013, and I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3377. Regina.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3377 has no revenue impact, and it may have a fiscal impact if the statement has not been issued. It limits the amount of the Oregon State Lottery Commission to 1% or less of gross proceeds of state lottery and biennium to advertise state lottery. It mandates a portion of money spent on advertising to be directed to prevention and treatment of addiction and other emotional and behavioral problems related to playing state lottery.
Thank you. Representative, welcome to our committee.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Chair Tomei, members of the Human Services Committee. For the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37. So a little bit way of background for those of you who've already heard a lot of lottery bills, you'll know that we spent quite a significant amount of time in the last year talking about the lottery, about problem gambling, about how the lottery expends its money. And I want to talk, so we've discussed a lot of those things, but this bill is really one of the components we've talked about in our small subcommittee work group was about the lottery spend. Currently in the biennium, the lottery spends a little over $26 million on advertising. And the thing that really kind of caught my attention as somebody with a business background is the return on the investment piece for the lottery advertising based on where the revenue comes from and against the expenditure of $26 million of biennium for advertising. The lottery in fiscal year 2012 generated net over a little over $1 billion in revenue. About three quarters of that, we learned in our small work group, was generated by video poker. In the lottery advertising budget, some of the documents that we've had was that in that same fiscal year, 2012, the lottery spent only $500,000 to promote the video poker piece. So if the majority of the revenue is coming from video poker and the least part of the advertising budget is to advertise video poker, I have a little bit of concern and heartburn around the $26 million in a biennium and where the rest of that goes. Now, I fully understand, and the lottery and Larry Nicewander from the lottery has been really fantastic, and I'm sure he's felt very beat up on by us trying to solve some of these things, because he does have a duty to balance the revenue-making process with the whole commensurate with the public good piece. And so, which we've, those of us in the committee, I think, believe that the commensurate with the public good piece is the problem gambling and the societal impact of gambling, and trying to solve that with then the lottery does good things. And forgive me, I can't find the little sheet that had the kind of breakdown, but the lottery does expend money for point of sale. I have no heartburn with point of sale merchandise, although some of it questionable little sleeves and things at the Oregon Lottery that you stuff your Powerball tickets into. My son brought me one of those the other day. So I question some of the logoed merchandise-y type feel. The lottery sponsored, for example, Portland Community College's 50th anniversary dinner and gave us all nice little bags that said Oregon Lottery on them, and they were one at every seat. I mean, that type of spending in a tight budget times is really not acceptable to me as somebody who's kind of frugal. So this bill, what this is designed to do is really get the lottery to look at, what it's spending on, look at the ROI for the advertising. I think, when I talk to voters, I'm out knocking doors, the kind of fluff ads of the lottery does good things, and they've got beer cans in Astoria, and, kind of this telling the story of the lottery, or TV spots doing that, that are expensive, probably not necessarily the most appropriate use of our money. The lottery advertising piece, in my mind, should be really about things that are directed to the actual production of revenue and not the narrative piece of why we have the lottery or why it does good things. I think there's an opportunity to see the lottery reduce that expenditure and redirect those dollars back to the original purposes of the lottery, schools and fish and economic development. So to be able to redirect those dollars back So I'm okay with point of sale materials. I'm okay with, you know, the billboards that say this is how much the Powerball is worth. I get that's directly related to the sale and advertising of lottery. Some of the other things that the lottery has been advertising on, not necessarily okay with. And I guess the real kick for me, I've been watching this for before I got to the legislature, not just with the lottery. I own an online business. And the first time I saw an Oregon Health Authority ad pop up in my paid advertising that we have contracted out with, like, Google and other providers, and watching a, you know, DHS ads show up on a website where demographically the fit was wrong, looked, you know, this was in 2007, I'm looking at this going, what is the state of Oregon thinking? And so in starting to track this and look at this, you know, there's a lot of this advertising going on. And again, in a tight budget scenario, I think there's an opportunity here to really evaluate the way we do business and think about how we redirect those savings somewhere else. And so those are the types of things that I'm that this bill is hoping to limit. There are a couple flaws in the bill, and we need to work on an amendment with them. The percentage needs to actually be a little bit less. It's about a half a percent, not 1%, but it's a half a percent per year. Of the, and it's of the net. LC drafted this and they put gross and it is supposed to be of the net. On the back, or on the page 2 of the bill, line 1, where it's talking about spending $2 million of advertising directed to the prevention and treatment of addiction, the current spend in fiscal year 2012, based on my notes, was about $800,000 on the problem gambling ads. This is actually looking to bump that up, and the $2 million should say $2 million per year. So the way I kind of look at this is that in a biennium, if you know, the projected was $26 million, in a biennium, if you had $4 million going to problem advertising and bumping that number up so that more than 1,500 people find us and reach us to access the state-sponsored addiction treatment, we did 1,500 people in fiscal year 11. So bumping that number up to $4 million, and again, I don't have the number for what the point of sale was, but it wasn't outrageously huge. I mean, I think we can get that lottery number down, you know, at least somewhere between $7 and $10 million. That's what I'd like to see based on the numbers that I saw, and particularly, again, going back to the piece about the revenue where three-quarters of the lottery is generated based on video poker, and yet in that fiscal year, they're only expending $500,000. The rest of it's just going to other pieces of this, and I think it's time to rethink how we advertise, not just in the lottery, across all of our agencies who have these pretty hefty advertising budgets, and they're advertising in movie theaters and billboards, and you know, and you go to the airport and there's a big lottery ad there, and the airport doesn't even sell a lottery ticket. So, I mean, that's the type of stuff that I want us to start thinking about as a group, and I'm hoping that with some cleanup to this bill, we can have that conversation. I would also hope that it's something that the Lottery Commission could do on its own, but I don't. I think they're probably going to need some direction from us.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I should know this, having served on that task force with you. Do you know what a half a percent of net sales is approximately?
Yes, a half a percent is going to be roughly, I believe, $5 million in a fiscal year.
Okay.
So that gives you $10 million in a biennium, which is a little, you know, closer to about $11 million a biennium, if I have my numbers right in my head, versus $26 million.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, I should know this. I was on Ways and Means last session, but didn't we eliminate some of the advertising in the budget last session?
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett, yes, I think because we brought some of those things forward. You know, while I appreciate everybody on Ways and Means and who's doing all the big budget numbers, you know, my office for the last couple of years has been going through the checkbook. Yeah. So that's line-by-line transactions into agencies and, you know, looking at the outdoor billboard advertising or prizes for staff or things that have some really, across all agencies, not just lottery, have some really interesting coding for how money's getting spent at a time when we can't, we're struggling to fund teachers and we're struggling to fund, you know, home care for seniors, et cetera. It is time for the state to get really frugal and tighten down on the non-essential expenditures.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow up real quick.
Follow up?
I concur with that, and I think it's good to put it in statute at times, and that's what you're basically doing here. But how does what happened last time versus this, your proposal, or where you're thinking of going, is about the same? Or?
Well, I don't believe, and Larry Nicewander can correct me, I don't believe the lottery made that adjustment the way other agencies did in the Ways and Means process, because they're a little bit outside, a little bit outside of that, as I understand it.
Thank you.
Representative Whitson.
I don't know if you can answer this. Do we have any idea if or how much the tribes contribute to problem gambling treatment from the tribal casinos?
You know, we've talked about this a little bit. They kind of have some of their own programs. They tend to be, I'd say, restricted to the reservations and tribal, you know, their tribal community. The 1,500 people who went through treatment in Oregon in 2011 were people who found the phone number attached to, you know, a sticker on the machine that had a call this number, and they were our Oregon video poker machine. So we do not have an expectation that tribal governments who are sovereign are contributing to Oregon's problem gambling program that comes out of and funded out of lottery.
Do we know how much money is going into the tribal casinos by Oregon citizens? What is their part of the gambling monies for the state here?
You know, Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, I don't have that figure. That would probably be part of their proprietary, you know, type sales information. They don't share that with us. They're not obligated to share that with us. I will say that the 1,500 people who went into Oregon treatment, I think, represented and warranted to the state that the majority of their gambling losses were incurred via the Oregon lottery system. Those 1,500 people self-reported an estimated $37 million of gambling loss. So the intention here in helping to change the structure of how the lottery does their advertising and bumping up that number from, and the note I got today was that they're looking at a $2 million spend this year for the biennium, and I'd like to see that be even higher, is to really try to reach out to more of those folks. And like I said, I do believe that the tribal governments do operate their programs, but it really, I think, is more restricted to their communities.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you for coming today. Appreciate that. Appreciate you bringing this bill. We're going to call up Larry Nicewander and Stacy Shaw.
How about that's about right? You're doing a good job.
Chair Tomei, committee members, for the record, Larry Nicewander, director of Oregon Lottery, and to my right and to your left is Stacy Shaw, assistant director for marketing with the Oregon Lottery, also to talk briefly to you. Given the interest in the other bills and the testimony that you want to get on the public hearing, we'll be very brief. Also, in light of the proposed changes and amendments to the bill that were described by Representative Parrish, we'll probably need to come back and just adjust our testimony accordingly, because the change from gross proceeds to net proceeds and the change from 1% to 0.5% changes some things significantly, and I wouldn't want to leave the committee with conclusive information about that without seeing the bill in its actual language as amended. Just so I touch briefly on the testimony, and I hope you all have it electronically. If you don't, I have hard copies I can give the staff. Are we good?
Yeah, I need a hard copy.
So okay.
Thank you. I've been told to send my packet, Larry, so no problem. I've got my packet. Pardon?
Yeah, and we've got it in our packets.
Okay. Sorry, go ahead.
Just briefly, following up on Representative Parrish's comments, the lottery is a challenging mission, as you know, to maximize revenue commensurate with the public good. And so we are about ensuring that we take on those activities to do that. And so the testimony just provides you with the three areas where how we interpret our mission. You know, we really are trying to return maximum profits, to provide stable sales performance, commensurate with the public good, and so that we are providing a reliable revenue source for programs and services, and we have a track record of being able to do that. We are, operating more like a business than a state agency than most other entities that come before this body, and we are challenged operationally with the ability to compete with others. others. And so you see in our testimony those operational challenges. It's the economy, the downturn of the economy, and competition from tribal casinos who advertise freely and often. Our player base is changing. And so we are actually quite involved in advertising to educate players. A lot of our core players are aging, retiring, or passing on. And so to bring on a new generation of players to let them know about this entertainment option and choice that the state has sanctioned is an important one for us to maintain stability and viability. The next generation of players, they travel and shop in different areas than the traditional lottery player in past. So we're trying to advertise to ensure there's knowledge and education about that. And many of the games that we offer are not known much about, so we use that advertising to inform players. I won't go into the section at the bottom of page 2 too much because the proposed amendments are going to change significantly, but I just wanted you to know from a practical standpoint, the Lottery Commission, appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, 5-member, do an annual budget for us, and they approve it. In terms of general parameters, the commission has always approved our advertising budget to be 1% or less per year, and our public information budget to be about 0.5% or less per year. And so if amendments come forward and say that the lottery should restrict that to 0.5% per year, it would be cutting it in half. So in terms that Representative Perry spoke to, approximately $10 million at 1% would reduce to $5 million. So a cut of 50% would be significant. It would be something that the commission has the ability to entertain and consider, and we'd come back and try to share with you what effect we might that might have should you choose to move that amendment at that level forward. Part of what we budget for outside of advertising is what's called public information. In my testimony, I talk about that briefly, and we separate advertising of our products from public information. And the public information piece is the responsible gambling messaging that we do, that Representative Parrish referenced to be about $2.9 million in the last 2 years. And then the other piece of it is what we call the Oregon Wins campaign, which is a campaign that Stacy will speak to briefly. But it is a campaign that informs the public about how lottery funds are being used. How are they coming back to do good things? What is the public use of those funds? And we have received considerable feedback on the public support that garners, the awareness it garners of how funds are being used, and confirms to the citizens that it is doing what they voted for it to do, which is return money to education, return money to natural resources, and return money for economic development. So at the bottom of page 3, I just wanted to highlight for you, we have asked for and received some advice recently regarding what is the lottery able to use its administrative funds for in relationship to responsible gambling. And the reason that's relevant is because of the portion of the bill that talks about the requirement that $2 million per biennium would be a fixed amount to be spent on and specifically to prevent and treat addiction and other emotional and behavior problems related to lottery games. And I just wanted to say at this time I will share the opinion with Representative Parrish again so that she has that in her hands when she talks to council about any amendments, because those exact words, based on this opinion, would drive to the need for that $2 million to probably have an alternative fund source. Lottery wouldn't be able to use its direct funds for that. Funds would have to possibly go to the health authority and then back to lottery under a separate formula for us to actually spend them in that regard. And that's just based on the legal advice that is brand new. And I will tell you, we're still sorting through the implications of that so that we can inform policymakers and actually our own staff as to how that might affect things going forward. Beyond that, I think I'm going to, since there is some intention to restrict lotteries advertising, I was going to give the last few minutes of my testimony time to Stacy just to talk about the value of advertising, since that would be the policy choice before you as to whether or not you do restrict it, and then if so, to what level.
I know I have a question of your representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question about the $2 million that you were just talking about. You're not referring to the $2 million a year that's for advertising of prevention and treatment of addiction, correct? Because in the bill, she talks about she's not talking about the treatment dollars. It's This is referring to the advertising budget for the treatment programs?
It is in effect part of our advertising budget to spend money for responsible gambling. And so both of them really, both public information as well as our general line item of advertising are really both public information that would, in a broad sense, is advertising. So we are talking about that portion of it.
Okay, but you were talking about needing to set up a separate fund or something like that?
There are certain allowable uses of lottery budgeted funds for certain forms of public information and that supports the responsible gambling communications. And so we are using some funds from within our budget for those things. But they're limited in terms of what we can do that's considered to be part of the operation of the lottery. This legal opinion that just came out is going to probably further define what we can and can't do under responsible gambling. And the language in the bill before you does cross over into what we've pretty much specifically been told we can't be involved in things that relate to specific treatment or specific prevention-focused activities that are not incidental to running a lottery.
Advertising for those.
It really didn't use the word advertising,
okay.
It said activities.
I just want to make sure we're talking about advertising for treatment on one side and then the treatment on the other side.
Yeah, it was really just, I think it was expenditures of funds for purposes of prevention and treatment was specific to that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei and committee members. For the record, I'm Stacy Shaw, Assistant Director for Sales, Marketing, and Retail Services for the Oregon Lottery. Wanted to talk to you a little bit about the impact of advertising on sales. And in the testimony, I'm going into quite a bit of detail, but I wanted to hit some of the high points for your consideration. Our ability to allocate our funds to support advertising for our products lets us do a lot of things that we need to do to both achieve our mission and achieve it commensurate with the public good. We need to be able to allocate to support new game introductions, new game features, to continue to educate our audiences and new audiences, and to maintain favorability. Director Nicewinder referred to Oregon Wins. That is one of the things we use relative to helping us maintain our favorability. This allows our Oregonians to make informed decisions on whether they want to spend their entertainment dollars on things that go back to their state. And it gives them the certainty, as the director said, that the funds are being used as they had set them up to be used. One of the things that we found through ongoing research is that although the lottery does offer what we term spinning reels or line games, a lot of Oregonians are unfamiliar that these games exist. While they frequent the types of establishments and the retailers that have them, they don't try them because they don't know they're there. So it is important for us to continue to let them know and give them the appropriate education on how to use them. We've done a lot of studies, and there have been a lot of industry studies that prove that advertising for this type of product is effective, and we have proven that advertising has helped us maintain our current sales levels, but also that we can do promotional activities to respond to current market conditions or other like incidences to increase sales. And again, that our TV and TV drives awareness and opinion, which leads to favorability. We also see that when advertising is eliminated or restricted unnecessarily, that it can reduce participation and doesn't allow us to educate new players. Advertising is an ongoing effort because with all the media and everything people see, advertising impact depreciates rather quickly within 6 months. So just because we have mature things doesn't mean we don't have to continue to inform people about them. We have seen in other studies that when advertising is cut, there is a proportional decrease in the amount of sales, which would be counter to our mission. And also, in closing, our category spending is low across a variety of comparisons. If we look at other U.S. lotteries, their spending is somewhere between unadvertising and not including public information is between 0.04 and 0.42%. We average for advertising around 0.8%. For the last 3 years, that's been about our average. And in terms of other industries, retail industries like our own, when you look at pharmaceuticals, packaged goods, other consumer products, that the advertising ranges from 2 to 6% of overall sales. So,
great. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you for coming. In our little summary here that was provided to us, it states that problem gambling may lead to disruption of psychological, physical, social, vocational aspects of living, and I disagree with that because I think it does lead to it. But my question is, you all know it pays to advertise, and you emphasize in your mission that you're supposed to make money for the state of Oregon, commensurate to the public good, which is open to interpretation, and I think I may have a different interpretation than a lot of people on this panel. But are you saying, in your way of thinking, does this bill say that if you advertise a little bit, we'll have fewer addictive gamblers? But if we advertise more, we'll get more addicted gamblers? Because it doesn't make any sense to me. It's counterintuitive for us to sit here, because the people, and we've had people in here with some very sad stories that I'm very compassionate about, but the people that are addicted are the people that run the state of Oregon, the people that are here and the people that are there. We're addicted to the lottery, and now we're playing this game that somehow if we keep squeezing the billion out of you, but we feel good about ourselves because we're limiting the advertising, it doesn't make sense to me. And the last thing I would say is it sounds to me like we're asking you, as the fox, to guard the chicken or the chicken coop.
Question in here, Representative Gilliam.
Yes. So what in my tirade did make any sense to you? And what do you have to say?
Chair Tomei and Representative Gilliam. No, you're right in how that's a difficult place for us to be. But our advertising is so strategically spent. We do not want to do anything that's going to create by its design problem gamblers or issues that further create criticism, quite frankly, for a product that we want to offer responsibly and in a sustainable manner so that it does continue to be publicly supported. So whether we spend what we spend today, which is less than 1% on advertising, or cut it in half, we're going to be as responsible as we can be regardless. I have no intention of creating problem gamblers. In fact, it works against us, as evidenced by some of the public testimony you've received. So we have a tough mission, and we're trying to advertise. We don't believe we're creating more problem gamblers through our advertising. We're trying to create a broad and diverse player base so that everybody plays a little.
You know what would be helpful? Representative, well, she's gone now, Kenny Geyer, and Representative Julie Parrish, and Representative Bill Kennemer and I were on the task force that looked at this over the last couple of years. I think it would be really helpful to know, as you're talking about the games and the different offerings, it would be helpful to know which, I would assume Lime games would be some of the advertising that go to the Lime games, and some of them would go also to the checkoffs,
Scratch tickets.
Scratch tickets, yeah. It would be helpful to know what the advertising, which of those
categories,
components it went to. That would be really helpful for me to know. And we'll maybe be calling you back when we have the amendment.
Sounds great.
Great. Any last questions? Thank you so much. You've all been very helpful, actually. Thank you. With that, we're going to be closing the public hearing on House Bill 3377. Open up the public hearing or informational hearing on House Bill 2872. Okay. And if you remember, colleagues, we had wanted somebody from the treasurer, thank you, from the treasurer, to give us some information about House Bill 2872. So thank you for coming today. Oh, she's going to give us a slideshow.
We'll make it brief. But
great.
For the record, my name is Laura Lockwood McCall. I'm the director of the Debt Management Division in the Oregon State Treasury. I watched the hearing about a week and a half ago, and so I knew that there were some questions, and I'll try and make this brief, but in another role that I have in the State Treasurer's Office, I staff the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission, and while in addition to looking at the overall debt capacity, general fund and law and revenue bonds, we also talk about emerging issues in debt area, and so we think that the reorganization, while noble in effort, could have some unintended consequences unless folks recognize and realize what we have outstanding currently in terms of debt and the various programs for housing. This summary sheet, and I hope you have a handout because it's a lot of numbers, but I wanted to highlight just a few things. Currently, we have $1.46 billion in outstanding housing bond debt in the state. That's in several different indentures. Some are for single-family loan programs. Some are for multifamily housing projects. Some of them are conduit revenue bonds where the state doesn't have any skin in the game, but we do it on behalf of other little local nonprofit financiers. Well, there's just a lot of complexity in housing finance, probably more so than in almost any other things we do. But if you think about it, it's a mortgage bank, and we have $1.5 billion in debt, and we have loans that pay off the debt. And so that's a fairly complex sort of management process that I just want to make sure that people in the legislature are aware of, that will continue on even if we reorganize or even eliminate the housing and send off its services to different places. One of the things, I just made a laundry list, and I won't go through them today. There's lots of people wanting to hear about other things. But this is just a list of all the back office things that you do when you sell bonds. In addition to paying the debt service, which is the obvious thing, you have to keep track and account of every single loan. You have to keep track of every prepayment, and you call bonds when there's prepayments. You have to let investors know if you call bonds. We have 145 different bond series with this $1.5 billion of debt. So you can just imagine the enormous accounting effort involved by a relatively small staff. We also have interest rate swaps. These were done for single-family bonds. We sold a number of variable rate bond series to lower the interest cost we paid, and then we passed that savings on to first-time home buyers, and then we swapped back into a fixed rate to eliminate the variable rate risk. We estimate that we saved in the neighborhood of $13 million by doing that. We passed on those savings. However, taking care of all of that, which are all these variable rate bonds and all these swaps, is a little bit more than your average work of just having some debt service schedules. You have to update liquidity agreements. You need to mark to market your swaps. And so, again, it takes a little bit higher level of staffing and a little bit more technically skilled staffing than your average bonds. Some other things that we have to do is we have to stay in compliance with the IRS. So every single bond series has to have an annual calculation of the interest earnings on the various proceeds and loan payments. And we also have to disclose to investors for every single bond series, every single year, the financials. So folks have to prepare massive financials and then post those to a website called Emma, which is similar to EDGAR in the private sector. And failure to do any of those things could bring a lot of problems and trouble to the state in terms of IRS audits, SEC investigations, and the like. And even though this is a self-contained revenue bond program, we really don't want anything to besmirch the state's name when it comes to selling GO bonds for the state, of which we have several billion as well. So keeping this program happy and functional and well-run is super important in and of itself, but also to help the rest of the state's debt management continue to function as well as possible. This is just a list of some of the material I said. I'll just submit it to the record. Then the only other thing I wanted to mention was in another role I have in the State Treasurer's Office, we have a private activity bond committee that allocates private activity bond authorization for various other multifamily housing deals. And what I'll note is both for those deals and other conduit deals that housing works on, there's often affordable housing tax credits offered to developers, both 9% and 4% for very low-income housing. And in order to authorize those tax credits, there has to be someone around to do ongoing compliance to make sure that all those multifamily housing projects remain in an affordable housing mode through the life of the tax credits. So someone has to take care of that above and beyond just the bond work. And while OST wants to help, and we're more than happy to work on liquidity agreements, swap agreements, sell bonds, work on all that, we just are not staffed to take care of the loan, everyday loan payments. We're not really staffed to deal with, for example, if there's failure to pay loans, to follow through with mortgage insurance, delinquencies, foreclosure. And this just gives you a list. Currently, they have over almost 7,000 single-family borrowers in their loan program, and in the neighborhood of 350, 60-plus multifamily housing projects around the state, which is a lot of people and phone calls and making sure everything gets paid every month. So with that, I'll thank you for the time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Representative Whitsitt.
I have three questions, if I may. The first one, how much of the $1.5 billion in housing debt is guaranteed by the state of Oregon in any capacity?
Through the chair, Representative Whitsitt, we do have a general obligation bond program for elderly and disabled. So I've broken that out separately, and $120 million is in that mode. And I'm not quite sure how many individual projects are in that, but that's the only one where the state's guaranteed its full faith and credit. The balance are direct revenue bonds, which totals approximately $1.2 billion. And the only revenue stream is the revenues of the loans. And then finally, we have some conduit, a couple hundred million of conduit revenue bonds, where we're just really a pass-through.
Oh, okay. May I follow up? So could you describe the total debt services biennium on the $1.5 billion, and what is the default rate?
Through the chair, I don't have off the top of my head. I think I had some backup material. I'm going to ballpark estimate that annual debt service in $1.4 billion is probably well over $100 million, but I could get you an exact number. As far as default rates on the underlying loans, I'm going to have to turn to the director and her staff to give you some answers. I know the default rates have gone up a bit in the last few years compared to historically. But we've never missed a payment on any state bond in this program ever. So we have reserves in place to handle those situations and insure mortgage insurance.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Margaret, I see you're here. And if you don't need to come to testify, maybe send us the information to Debbie and she'll give it to the rest of us. Thank you. Representative Gallegos, did you have a question?
No, ma'am.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt asked a couple of my questions, but I wondered how many people you have working on just the debt for the housing.
Through the chair, Representative, we currently have one full-time staff person in Treasury who works with the agency when they sell bonds, but the deputy director and myself also jump in and get involved. So I don't know that you could say it's my full-time, but during liquidity renewals where we're fighting with the three banks left in the world that have decent credit ratings, it was all of my time nonstop for 3 months, as well as a DOJ attorney. It's just getting harder and harder to do those liquidity renewals. And so, and they would be able to speak to how many staff they have. I think I've heard eight people in their unit who manage the accounting as well. My whole staff, by the way, just full-time, that includes all the GO bonds, DOT, lottery revenue, is six and 0.6 FTEs. So we're a very lean organization in terms of our stretch, and we also do track local government debt and run school bond guarantee programs, et cetera.
So just a quick comment that's a great return on investment to have gotten $13 million in reissuance of bonds.
We appreciate that. We also refund a lot of state bonds and have done well. So in Treasury, we just don't want to take on new tasks because we think that gives us an ability to focus on trying to save money for the state. But we need our partners and agencies who kind of have the staff of accountants and who manage the ongoing loans and debt.
Thank you very much. Any further questions? Seeing none, thanks for coming back today. With that, we will close the informational hearing on House Bill 2872. And we'll open up the hearing on House Bill 3132. Eva Rapito.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3132 directs the licensing agency to adopt rules ensuring caregivers within licensed residential facilities and adult foster homes possess required knowledge and skills, requires annual residential facility report to licensing agency on facility compliance with training requirements, and there's no revenue impact. And Madam Chair and members of the committee, regarding the fiscal impact, I have been informed that the agency is in communication with the Legislative Fiscal Office, and you will see possibly a different fiscal statement on this bill.
Different from
the one that is in your packet.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. Thanks for hearing House Bill 3132 and allowing me to testify. I also want to give special thanks to Representative Gorsuch and his staff for their help and support, and also for providing written testimony in support of the bill. My name is Eva Rapito, and I'm representing AFSCME Council 75 and our members who work in group homes for adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Some of my friends here in the building had raised some concerns about this bill as it applies to all residential care facilities. So I want to start off by saying I want to be clear that our intent was to get at issues that are specific to group homes for adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities that our members are seeing there. So I'm kind of new to this issue. When I got asked, I sat down with our staff representatives who work with the members directly and learned about all the issues that are facing group homes right now. And a lot of it is budgetary. So amongst this was increase that I asked, what do you need? And they said, well, more money. And I said, well, okay. So they would increase budget to go to direct care of clients through improved staff-to-client ratios, increased wages to decrease turnover of staff and improve continuity of care for their clients, and improve training to reduce the number of abuse complaints and investigations. So knowing that we're still in a little bit of a difficult budget climate, I thought it might be easiest to focus on the training. So we decided to focus on requiring education and training for employers to report to licensing agency based on being compliant with the education and training for several reasons. First, because of the decline in wages, the base wages are now at minimum wage. So there's a high turnover. This work is. They work with a lot of clients who have special needs, so it's not always the easiest work, and so some people get discouraged, and when they're not properly trained or they leave quickly, they're not getting people trained quickly enough. However, the law does currently state that a person may not provide care to any resident prior to acquiring the education or supervised training designed to impart the basic knowledge and skills necessary to maintain the health, safety, and welfare of residents. We'd like to change the law to include training in addition to education to make sure that employees receive more than a copy of statutes and rules that cover health, safety, wellness, and abuse. In some places, not all, that is the case. You know, some places our members are getting practical training, and in others they're handed paper that says, here are the rules, make sure you follow it. And it depends on others. They depend on other staff to do proper lifting procedures and other care procedures. There are clients in some cases that have, you know, specific dietary needs, specific needs in help with bathing and going to the restroom. And then there are other cases where some people, there was one case, Megan Moyer was going to talk about it, but I don't know if she's going to make it in, where a client died because she had pica, and she ate latex gloves that were left out, and had the staff been properly trained to know that they shouldn't leave that out, then that person would still be with us. So The other thing that they've seen is that there's been a decrease in investigators in some areas, and this is also due to budget. So with a decrease in the number of investigators, investigations are taking longer than the 45 days set forth in administrative rule, causing employees of group homes to be out of work for months, creating more turnover because they then give up on waiting for their case to be cleared, or even in some cases when it's been unfounded or unsustained abuse claim, they're still let go because the provider's been told that the employee needs more training. So having properly trained employees in the first place would hopefully reduce the number of cases originated. Investigators are hearing from employees that under investigation that they haven't been properly trained, but then when the investigator goes to the employer, there's no written documentation of when, where, and what types of trainings that the employees have received. So it's kind of this person says one thing and this person says another. So that's part of the investigation process. It takes a little bit clearer. So investigators have told me that this would help them in the very beginning of their investigation process by being able to say, I know that this employee was indeed trained on this issue on this date, and this is the type of training that they've received. So creating this paper trail by, making employers accountable to holding these trainings would help investigations too.
Eva, I'm going to encourage you to speed up.
Yes.
If, as I understood it, you were the only person coming to testify on this bill, and then I got a list of at least 9 people.
Oh, well,
so that's why I called you first, because I thought you were the only person, but you have 9 people at least on this list. Is that right? Yeah.
I'm sorry. I didn't understand. I thought you meant from AFSCME. I apologize, Chair Tomei.
Okay.
So, I'm almost done.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm sorry, Chair Tomei. We believe that strengthening education and training requirements and having employers prove that giving the proper training to their employees will help them better understand how to care for their clients, and it'll give investigators a way to double check that these trainings have indeed happened. And most importantly, it'll help ensure that clients in IDD group homes will get the quality of care that they need. So this is, it's about the clients and quality and continuity of care. So okay. Thanks for your time.
Okay, thank you very much. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and I think the list had ended there. Was there anyone else who had come to, who had wanted to testify on this but didn't have a chance to write their name down? Could you just put up your hand? Okay, I don't see anyone. So we have another bill, and I know there are a lot of people here to testify about 2971. We have 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. So if everybody wants to testify, and we've got an hour to go, we're going to have to limit your testimony to no more than 2 minutes. So I'm sorry, I'm going to have to do that. And what I'd like to, is anybody going to use this anymore? You're going to use this? Okay. For which?
2971.
For 2971. Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Eva.
Thank you, Chairman.
And so we will call up Tim Krall, Joe Green, and Jim Carlson. And I'm sorry that we're going to have to limit your testimony. You can always submit written testimony.
In the interest of time, Madam Chair, Mr. Greenman will present testimony, and I'll let him fly solo.
Thank you so much, Jim. I appreciate that. All right. Start right on.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim Krall, and I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. Our nonprofit members deliver jobs and homes to individuals with disabilities, mostly developmental disabilities, across the state. And I do have direct experience in this area. I started in 1975 as a group home house parent in Portland. We'd like to point out that we already are responsible. We take training very seriously. The administrative rules that are attached to your testimony and the core competencies that direct care employees must have before they can work unsupervised are attached. We do not believe simply adding a reporting requirement will help. there has been no increase in abuse and incident reports over the last several years. I pulled the data and looked, and you can check with the Office of Investigation and Training. This is a solution in looking for a problem from our perspective. But she's right. Our workers are low paid, they turn over too highly, and we create a negative spiral. We would love to see funding. In fact, we're seeking $15 million from the Ways and Means Committee and would encourage you to talk to them about the need in developmental disabilities to stop that kind of turnover. When we lose valuable trained employees, it's very expensive for all of us. Thank you very much.
Thank
and I'm
you
also
very much.
Dropping off testimony from the
yes.
Developmental Disabilities Coalition. This is 30 organizations, including the ARC, the DD Council, and many other nonprofits involved in the developmental disabilities field that also believe this is an unnecessary bill that would be an administrative burden, as does the Office of Licensing and Care, as does the Developmental Disabilities Office.
Thank you very much, and thanks for making it brief. This is going to be our timekeeper right here. How will you let them know?
When I say stop, you stop. That's all there is to it, okay?
No. Former cop. Like, all right. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, with one eye firmly fixed on Representative Olson. My name is Joe Greenman. I'm legal counsel with the Oregon Healthcare Association. I represent, Oregon Healthcare Association represents long-term care facilities throughout the state of Oregon, including residential care and assisted living facilities, which would be subject to House Bill 3132. I'm here today to essentially offer testimony, not necessarily in support or opposition, but to articulate some concerns about the prospects for including assisted living and residential care facilities in House Bill 3132. Under the current statute, the Department of Human Services has authority to promulgate rules requiring training for the facilities that we represent. And under Oregon Administrative Rule 411-054-0070, DHS has promulgated that rule, and it's been in effect in its current form since 2007 and much longer before that in other forms. DHS actually requires of assisted living and residential care facilities that all staff receive a training, not just caregiving staff. And my concern is that the way that 3132 is drafted, at least as it pertains to the membership that we represent, there is actually a potential that it could have a limiting impact on the currently existing rules, and it would limit it to just saying direct care staff would be the required elements, required personnel for training, and that currently existing rule that DHS has in place could potentially be skipped over because the statute would supersede that rule. So that's a concern I just want to articulate from the standpoint of having this be so broad and pulling our facilities into it. The other thing that we call attention to in the testimony that we provided is the reporting requirement. The training requirements right now are audited, and there's government oversight over them via an inspection process, via a complaint process, or any other reason that the department may have to suspect that the rules aren't being followed. The department has access and can evaluate those, and that's through an auditing process. This would require a reporting process, and I don't really know that that would help the process of DHS maintaining the standards. So with that, I will conclude my remarks.
You're done.
Thank the committee.
Madam Chair, real quick.
Yes.
Both of you guys, Jim and Joe, I'm interested as I'm reading through this bill and everything, and and you know it better than who provides the training?
The organization that hires the employees is subject to the administrative rules, and they're subject to delivering the core competency training. When the licensors come, they look at the individual personnel files and see the dates and types of training.
And our setting is roughly the same. Oregon Healthcare Association trains thousands of these caregivers. That's part of our professional development role that we play as well.
Okay, thank you.
So you do the training yourself?
Oregon Healthcare does, and the facilities can arrange through other means as well, but that's part of the role that we try to play for our members.
Great,
so,
thank you.
Okay, just a little more than Madam Chair. Okay, thanks. You guys, I'm looking at this here, especially in Section 2, and I'm trying to... what's going on there for adopt rules on this and then the training requirements. Does it appear that you're going to be involved at all in the development of the rules if we went this direction at all for what it looks like for training?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, typically the DD office has been very good about involving providers in the evolution of the developmental. We're currently commenting on and reviewing the core competencies right now with the division. So in that sense, yes.
Yeah, and from our perspective, Madam Chair, members of the committee, from our perspective, we have the same relationship with DHS where they actively recruit us to participate in the rulemaking process and have our say on it. But again, I mean, just our concern isn't necessarily with the specific new training requirements being put in, because I think if you look at our testimony, the training requirements that we already have in rule are rather extensive and lengthy. Our concern is the potential that it actually could water them down a little bit, and also the reporting piece. You know, in terms of having a piece where the providers have to sort of make a report on what the training is and send it into DHS, and then what would DHS do with that information? What role would they be playing with that information? I think that the process that we have now, where we have a record-keeping duty and responsibility, and the department essentially audits that.
Because
really,
of time, I'm going to stop you.
Okay.
But why don't you give us a written response to this?
Very good.
Give it to Debbie, and we'll make sure the staff gets it. Good question.
Actually, I'll follow up with them.
Well, I want the whole committee to know. So do respond in writing. Thank you.
I have a really quick question. What is the licensing agency?
For us, it's DHS.
For us, too, the DD office.
Okay. Loana Christ-Ray, I'm not sure. Megan Moyer and Mike Kantz. And Mike, I think, is the only person who's gone and has come more than 100 miles. Is he here?
I'm sorry, I'm just signing. I wasn't sure I was for coming down to testify.
Oh, so you don't want to testify. And what is your name?
Juana.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Go ahead, Megan.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm with the Service Employee International Union, Local 503. We represent a variety of different direct care providers. Specifically those impacted by this bill in its intent, which we understand, to be residential training centers and adult foster homes serving people with developmental disabilities. Within that framework, we do represent adult foster homes. We also do represent the frontline workers in two group home chains in Oregon. And we are here in support of the bill because training is such a fundamental part of making sure that the quality of services people are provided are maintained. And what we have seen with frontline workers and with adult foster care providers is that poor training can directly result in outcomes for individuals that can be tragic. It is not just knowing how to wash your hands and knowing how to report abuse and neglect, although those are critically important trainings as well. It is understanding the individual service plan of an individual in order to maintain their safety, their quality of life, and their self-determination. And unfortunately, we have an unequal record with providers, including adult foster homes, in how thorough they are in explaining, one, the value and importance of an individual service plan, but also how should that individual in their daily work be respecting and following that service plan. There have been tragic stories. Eva from Ask Me did reference a particularly sad story from Washington County that happened in December that was a direct result of staff not being familiar with an individual service plan, and that resulted in a death. Obviously, we want to make sure that not only are the rules strong, but we're documenting in order for the safety and protection of all.
Thank you, Megan. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, my name is Mike Lance. I appreciate you taking a moment today. This is the first time I've done this, so I'm kind of nervous on this. I would like to start off by saying that on behalf of my wife and I, we do oppose this rule change. But we own two adult care homes in Bend. One is a specialized home that takes care of very heavy care folks that was once part of the On the Move program, which was the money follows the person. Our other care home is a private pay care home. And although we do understand that the value of training is of utmost importance, every individual has individual needs. And the classes that are offered through various distributors of medical supplies or answering the question that Representative Olson had earlier who is providing the training. Durable medical equipment folks will provide training for certain pieces of equipment, for example. One of the things that we've run into is we have a resident who is a brittle diabetic. There's not really a class out there to cater to that specific person's needs. In that case, we have a nurse on staff that is able to delegate individual caregivers for the task at hand, for blood sugar checks and for providing insulin shots. At this point, with the adult foster care homes, those types of tasks don't count towards any kind of continuing education requirements, as well as first aid and CPR are not counted towards any kind of continuing education, which we'd like to see change at some point in time, although those are the necessary type items. As far as the types of people that we bring in, we not only assess them on what their needs are, but also the needs of our caregivers. Are our caregivers able to take care of the person that we're bringing in? And there have been times when we've said, you know, this person is not an appropriate fit for our home. And so we need to be able to make that assessment at that point. The current foster care home rules also have a section in there, which I put in a handout, that states that the local office is capable of saying, you're going to need to have additional training for this particular resident. It's something that's going to be required. And I would like to see that happen at the local office as opposed to at this level. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming in. Thanks for coming so far, and have a safe trip back home.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So now we have Cindy Porter, Marion Decoy, I'm not sure, and Matt Evans. And I think those are the last people on House Bill 3132. Thank you for coming, and just start right up.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. I am Cindy Porter, and I own an adult foster home in Portland. I'm here to speak in opposition to HB 3132. Legislation like HB 3132, however well intended, places an extra load on adult foster home owners. This bill will add more paperwork, increase my expenses, and take more time away from caring for my residents. This bill will cause adult foster homes to become less like a family home atmosphere and more like an institutional atmosphere. It will cause less time to be available to focus on creating a family atmosphere and to spend time with the residents. It is already difficult to find a caregiver to work for the amount I can pay them because of the low reimbursement rates under Medicaid. Reimbursement rates for Medicaid residents of adult foster homes have not increased in over 5 years, while our costs have skyrocketed. If caregivers are required to have more training and spend more of their time and their money to qualify to work in the adult care homes in the first place, it will make it next to impossible to find caregivers. It's already hard to find caregivers right now. I've been trying lately. When I hire a caregiver, it is mainly to hand out medications and make meals that I have already prepped. No specialized training is required. I don't want them to focus on any of the upkeep of the house. I have someone else do that. But rather to spend time with the residents, because I don't even have a lot of time to do that. A caregiver is not a resident manager or an operator like myself. They are just here to substitute for short intervals. So thank you for your time, and I urge a no vote on HB 3132.
Thank you for being so brief. Appreciate you coming.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Matt Evans. I'm the executive director of the Independent Adult Foster Home Association, and here to urge a no vote on this particular piece of legislation. Most of what needs to be said, I think, has been. I want to wax a little philosophical if I can. It's very important to understand that when additional administrative and paperwork burdens are placed on adult foster home operators, that takes time away from their ability to care for our most vulnerable seniors. The truth is that most of the adult foster homes are run by typically a husband and wife team. And to have them have then to take time to do additional paperwork, that is not time spent with their residents. And it's pretty clear to me that the level of care, the quality of the care, must necessarily suffer if people are having to spend time on things other than being with their residents, developing activities for their residents, making sure that their residents are properly medicated where that's indicated, and so forth. So the association is concerned about this bill. We believe that the current training is sufficient. The association provides, to answer a previous question from Vice Chair Olson, the association provides training for our members. Other organizations and individuals provide it, and we believe it's sufficient to provide the sort of excellent care that adult foster homes are providing all across this state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Matt. So you've been really great, but if you have any quick questions, Representative Whitsitt.
I don't know who can answer this. How many total care providers are there in Oregon that this would affect, and how many residents of the homes?
We may not have that.
Yeah, Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, there are about 1,800 adult foster homes in Oregon, and it varies from month to month as folks leave the business and others come into the business. The maximum number of beds available in each of those homes is 5. I don't believe most have 5 residents, but you can see that the maximum number is, 9,000 folks in adult foster homes.
And we can contact Jim Carlson, who can probably give us those figures, and maybe you can help us remember that, Regina. Thank you for asking. Any other quick questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you so much
for coming. Okay, with that, I think that's everybody who's signed up to testify on House Bill 3132. Did I miss anybody? Seeing not, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3132 and move to House Bill 2971.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2971 has no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement was issued. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It appropriates to the Department of Human Services for the biennium beginning July 1, 2013, from the general fund,
$1,880,000.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for enhancement and expansion of independent living center services to persons with disabilities. Declares emergency effective on passage.
Representative Gilliam, could you be our timekeeper? There's a thing right there.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you. Okay. Oh, we have a panel. All right. Here we go. But unfortunately, you've got 2 minutes each.
We understand. Okay. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you very much. My name is Barry Fox Kwame. I'm the president of the Association of Oregon Centers for Independent Living, the 7 centers, independent nonprofits around the state that serve across disability population in Oregon. With me is Sheila Thomas from our center in Eugene, Lane Independent Living Alliance, and Kurt Toombs from the Eastern Oregon Center for Independent Living that operates out of Ontario and Pendleton and covers about a third of the state. In the interest of time, we would have decided to not give our PowerPoint presentation. We provided that to Honorable Chair's staff, so I believe you have that. And I'll try to, in the interest of time, my colleagues have, if it's all right with the Chair, deferred 1 minute of their time to me for our opening statement, and then they'll add a couple of comments to illustrate some of the programs we're providing.
Great.
Thank you. We're here today to testify to the tremendous
microphone. There you go. Good.
So thank you. Tremendous outcomes that Centers for Independent Living realize each year to benefit the people with disabilities across Oregon. We're happy to present you today with a kind of a modern fairy tale that's come to life, and we've had a chance to share that with some of you individually. You know, most of us are familiar with the magical story of spinning straw into gold, and SILs across Oregon have been transforming what some have called budget dust into gold bars and saving Oregonians millions of dollars each year for the past decade, and especially over the past 4 years with increases in the service needs. As we visited with members of the legislature this session, many observed that in asking for $1.88 million in new funding for SILS that HB 2971 is asking for budget dust, and it might be hard to even get the attention of members. So first of all, thank you for listening to our voices. We have consumers from our centers from all over the state who are here today, some of who are traveled from Ontario and Pendleton. While our funding request may seem small in some circles, please be assured that that $1.88 million is very significant for in the lives of people with disabilities.
Pardon me, Madam Chair, he had a request to get some of the other time. It's now 2 minutes. Are you granting him more time?
I'll give you one more minute. How's Fine. That?
Okay.
Pardon the interruption.
Thank you. Thank you.
So let me just say that for each of us at this table and in the room that we've gathered from across the state, this issue is very personal for us. We're unique voices because we're not only describing the problem, but we're representing the solutions through peer-based self-advocacy centers around the state. The added funds that we're requesting, first of all, are in response to an increase in services that we've been able to provide through case management services. Over the last 3 years, we've seen an increase from 5,600 consumers served to 11,000, and information and referral services similarly going up to about 16,000 from about 8,000. It's a very cost-effective program. And you know, in the interest of time, I'll refer you to our written testimony. I would like to introduce you, though, to Kurt Toombs, who has traveled across the state and is executive director at EOCIL, to share an example of one of the programs that are benefiting consumers, and then to do the same to have Sheila Thomas share an innovative program going on in Eugene. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair and members, thank you for hearing us today. I will be brief and just give you an example of one of the programs that we offer in Eastern Oregon is our independent living services for people living with HIV/AIDS. And what we do is we look at the whole person, starting from diagnosis to end-of-life decisions and placing control back in the hands of the individual, assisting them to maintain a well-balanced life and control and not dependent on medical models, but more self-reliance and self-control, which in the end outcome, the positive outcome is that it saves the state millions of dollars because someone is managing their own care and keeping a well balance. They're not dependent on health care or emergency services. They're more apt to live a well-balanced life, less dependent on other agencies and other individuals, and more dependent and self-reliant on themselves. So thank you. Great.
Thank you very much.
Chair to May, members of the committee, I'd like to add to the diversity of programs.
Just tell us your name.
Oh, sorry. Sheila Thomas, Executive Director of LILA in Eugene. To add to the diversity of programs that SILS offer, LILA is collaborating with Peace Health and their Acute Behavioral Health Unit, the Johnson Unit, to provide peer support services just prior to and following discharge from the unit. This project is funded by our CCO Trillium. We expect to demonstrate a reduction in the length of stay and also a reduction in readmissions to the acute unit during with providing support for the first 3 months following discharge. Peer support is unique in that the peer has a lived experience of their own recovery, which cannot be replicated by professionals. We also expect to increase consumer attendance at follow-up medical appointments, which missed appointments are a big financial drain on the outpatient healthcare system. Peer support services have well-established history and a demonstrated role in the independent living community and also in the field of mental health recovery. The use of peers reduces the need for and the use of mental health services over time, easing the financial burden placed on the healthcare system. Reliance on peers as part of the mental health inpatient aftercare represents a shift towards more peer-based, person-centered, integrated approach to recovery. Another positive is that we are providing employment for peers who have a personal history of recovery. From a cost-saving standpoint, it costs $1,200 to $3,000 a day for someone to be on the acute unit, depending on the level of treatment. The average stay is 11 days. Medicare will not reimburse for patients readmitted within 30 days. There's an average of two patients readmitted per month. In the last 7 months, Peace Health has provided $330,000 in unreimbursed care to Medicare patients alone. So in closing, peer support services provide an opportunity to enhance the continued wellness of the consumer while also saving costs to the healthcare system. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. And I see we have a couple of other people who've driven over 100 miles away, Linda Valentine and Tim Taylor and Bonnie Boyd. And so why don't you come on up, and then we'll go down in order.
Do you want water? Good, thanks.
Just start right out. Just don't lean in too close to the microphone.
Okay, and I have a very loud voice anyway.
Great.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Linda Valentine. I am currently an independent living specialist for Eastern Oregon Center for Independent Living. 5 years ago, I found myself, after 41 years of marriage, in a divorce. Devastated, depressed, nowhere to go, by myself, all alone. Thanks to Eastern Oregon Center for Independent Living, they gave me the opportunity to use my skills, even though there was a little age issue in there, and the fact that I have numerous disabilities. They gave me a job. I've been there 5 years now, and I am an independent living specialist, which is a job I am so grateful to have. I have served numerous clients since then because I am a case manager. So I am here in support of HB 2971. So thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to speak. I won't take up any more of your time.
Thank you for coming, and thanks for coming such a long way. So go ahead.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Toomey. My name is Bonnie Boyd, and I am in training to be the receptionist at Eastern Oregon Center for Independent Living. I, too, was a displaced worker, and I was really grateful that Eastern Oregon Center for Independent Living gave me the chance to rebuild my life and, because of my age, get a better training job that I can still do, because obviously I'm getting a little older. And thank you. And that's
thanks so much, Bonnie. We're all getting older.
That's a good thing.
Madam Chair, Tomei, and members of the panel, my name is Tim Taylor from Pendleton, Oregon. I would urge you to support this bill. Being a former client of EOCIO, I know what good work they do, and would urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming, driving such a long way. Now we will start the list going the other way. So we have Cora Jones, Aaron Soldano, and Lynn McKinney.
I'm from Eugene, Oregon. For the last 30 years, I have worked at independent living centers in California and here in Oregon. I wouldn't have that career if it hadn't been for a group of peer mentors with disabilities who encouraged me to go to school, get my master's degree, and have a productive life. Since that time, I've really devoted myself to helping other people with disabilities become productive members of the community. I teach a job readiness class, which helps people with disabilities overcome their barriers to employment and become taxpayers instead of tax users. I also am an instructor from the STEPS program, which helps people with disabilities these caregivers learn to become good employers, which helps them stay in their own home instead of having to go to infinitely more expensive long-term care. The cost savings and the savings in human life is tremendous. And I will now pass to Cora.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
Good afternoon. My name is Cora Jones. I'm originally from Alaska. I'm low vision. I have been a part of blind and visually impaired groups. I've attended college, BA in social work, and a master's in rehab teaching. And my goal was to work with blind and low vision as a career. I came to Oregon, Springfield, Eugene, and landed right in the center of Lane Independent Living Alliance at the beginning. I've not been a board member, but I've been active. My son is 14, and he's going to be low vision, and he has been a part of it also. My job is at Lane Independent Living Alliance, I do peer mentoring, advocacy, independent living skills, information referral, and resources. I'm also the coordinator of STEPS. But I empower people with disabilities. I encourage them to be as independent as possible and empower them. Empowerment is very important. We have the Peer Support Club, and that's you have to be a member of what you have to be a member of. And that gives people who have physical and hidden disabilities an opportunity to get out in the community and be a part of our community in Springfield and Eugene. And that's and we're here to help people. We are in partnership. We believe in the holistic approach. We have Disability Navigator from Lane Workforce Network. We do this. We train people in this STEPS program to help empower the people at home. So I send my trainers out there. And then we have. Voc Rehab, we work with Voc Rehab, so some of the people from Vocational Rehabilitation come to our center to take classes so they can be employed, so they'll continue their career, and sometimes maybe they change careers. We work with other communities, other agencies. We have support groups for people with disabilities.
Cora?
Yes.
Your time is up, dear.
Thank you.
That old softy over here wasn't going to tell you that. He sort of signaled me, so I would have to tell you.
He's a wimp.
He's a wimp, yes. Thank you, Cora. You've got a great story.
Thank you for putting it on the record.
Go ahead.
Hi, my name's Aaron, and since I got connected with Lila, they've helped me. I took the job readiness class. I took RAW, Housing 101. They've helped me fill out my SSDI and get me an attorney for that, and they've been advocacies, and I've done on-the-job training. So, and it's one of the places where I feel accepted and like a family.
That's great, Aaron. I'm really glad for you. And where are you living?
In Cottage Grove.
In Cottage Grove. Yeah. That's great. Good. Thank you so much. Thanks for all of you coming today. Mm-hmm. So now, Kathy Janesse, Sherry Stock, and Ryan Skelton.
Yeah.
Can't get any better right now.
Okay, go ahead.
We have some squeaky wheels in here.
You sure do.
My name is Kathy Jeunesse, or Catherine Jeunesse, and I am from Madam Chair Tomei. Excuse me for my lack of formality.
You're doing great.
The rest of the committee. I have been with the Lane Independent Living Alliance since its inception. I have been the RAW, the Work Readiness Alternative Work Coordinator and Facilitator for quite a few years. Also working with STEPS, facilitating. Both Lynn and Cora have already given you some background on that, so I won't continue with that. I wish that when I was in my early 20s that I would have had the exposure to independent living centers. It would have been so empowering for me. I've most of my life had to think outside the box and be my own advocate, and being a vocal person, it wasn't that difficult, but it certainly felt like an isolated life. And having a community that mentors and helps people with disabilities to go from feeling possibly helpless and hopeless to feeling empowered and independent and quite capable by example of those of us who have done it. I can't say enough good about what has happened in my own life, but in watching others that I have had the privilege of working with step up and find their voice and their self-identity and to grow into productive, tax-paying citizens of this society. I think that pretty much sums it up. I could go on and on and on, but in view of time, I will turn it over to
this gentleman. Thank you so much. My name is Ryan Skelton, and in addition to being a client of ILR and in Portland, Oregon, I'm also a licensed clinical psychologist. I was trained not far from here at Willamette University, just across the street. It's been my goal the entirety of my still young professional career to work with people with disabilities. And as part of that, I opened my own psychology practice in Portland. Part of opening a practice and starting a small business for people with disabilities is the fear that your federal and personal benefits will be negatively impacted by that experience. And this can lead us to lose things like health insurance, food stamp payments, and some of that is appropriate because there's a scaling back that should happen as one's income goes up. But during the process of starting a small business, there are, in fact, a number of highly complex federal programs that are designed to leave those benefits in place. And one of the things that ILR did for me was to explain that complex program and all of the reporting requirements that go along with that program so that I could preserve my federal benefits for as long as I was entitled to while in the process of fulfilling my life's ambition of starting a small business and helping people with disabilities to receive services. And not only myself entering the economy, but also the clients who I assist are then able to be more productive and more stable members of society as a result of that assistance. And without ILR, I wouldn't have been aware of how to utilize the programs that do exist in the most effective way possible.
Close.
That's the essential story of what I wanted to deliver today, and so in interest of time, I yield.
Thank you so much. We appreciate your story, and congratulations. I'm also a MSW.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Me
Thank
too.
You. Yes. Oh, he's a doctorate in science. Okay. Thank
and,
you,
and
Kathy.
MSW.
What?
Yeah.
Yes, I was in it.
Put a dollar in the bowl.
What does it mean?
True.
Oh, Tomei. National Association for Association of Social Workers. Blah blah blah
and,
blah.
Gotta put a dollar in the bowl.
Yes. Thank you. You're right. Sherry, is Sherry here? I thought I had Sherry's name down.
Is Sherry not here? Okay. Ryan's, we had Ryan, Diana Kiever, and Jim Johnson, and Josh Navarette. Just stop right on talking while they're coming on up.
All right. Chairman Tomey, members of the group. My name is Josh Navarrete. I'm a work incentive coordinator for LILA in Eugene. Basically, what I do, I'll give you a rundown, really quick rundown what I do. I assist clients who are receiving SSI or SSDI benefits, and I help them by giving them information about the safe nets that exist and incentives so they can go back to work without any fears. You'll be amazed of how many of my clients have told me, Josh, I didn't know this information. In reality, without the sales, who else could actually give this information to our clients? Many of them are actually excited about going back to work. They're actually in the process of finding work. They're receiving also assistance from VR, vocational rehab. So in reality, that creates a domino effect. A long time ago, I had a client who, I used to work for a different organization, and I find him a job after working with this person for so long. He finally got a job, and he started hiring people with disabilities from my program. So it is a domino effect. And sales have so much to do with empowering the client, our clients, to become better citizens, and like somebody else said, taxpayers. So I'm definitely for this bill, and I encourage you to, you know, vote and go for this one. Thank you.
Thank you, Josh. Next.
Okay. Hello, my name is Jim Jackson. I facilitate and volunteer at the ILR in Portland, Oregon.
Jim, could you back a little bit from you're too close.
Oh,
further
okay.
Back. There
Let me
you go.
Do that.
Good.
Let me do that. I should know this. I do music. Anyhow, I just want to say this program has really changed my life and many of the lives around that have participated in our program. People with disabilities tend to internalize the ableism in our society. And this program that I feel like it is, you know, the inherent part of music is part of every individual. And if you concentrate on the baby steps of learning how to go from, you know, where you are to where you want to be, that those skills are transferable. I mean, if we think about how do we inspire people to overcome that internalization, it's through getting passionate about something. And, you know, I love these guys helping. You know, I would love to pay my taxes more. Most blind people with disabilities are all about doing that if they feel like they can make those contributions. So all the different ways that ILR is helps people find that passion, we got to support that. So
thank you very much, Jim.
Hi, I'm Diana Kiva. I'm in Portland, Oregon. I've been with IR for several years. I also volunteer once a week. I volunteer there. And then one thing I really liked about the group is if I have an issue, if I need information like Social Security, food stamps, things like that, I don't have to call two people. I can call one organization and they can give me the information I needed. That's really helpful. After 7 years of working, I'm working kitty service dog. I'm finding kitty a service dog performance, and they are the biggest three reasons why I'm getting a service dog. Thank you.
Thank you. What kind of dog are you going to get? Do you know?
The love.
My favorite dog. That's great.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. You That's that. Great. Okay, we have only two more. Becky Emmert and Missy Elder.
Thanks. I think somebody checked the box after us, and it's fine to go ahead without. I checked no, and I think that the person behind me may have accidentally checked the box above me. They were confused.
So
it's fine not to testify in the interest of time.
Oh, we've got time now. We've got time if you want to testify. This lady does.
Sure.
I had to call her up earlier to ask her questions. Yeah. You've got your 2 minutes each. Sure, go for it.
You want to go first? Sure. My name is Becky Emmert, and I work with Lane Independent Living Alliance.
Well, that's time.
More time for interpreting. I am hard of hearing myself and experienced a traumatic brain injury after a car accident after receiving my master's in rehab counseling at Western Oregon University. And so it's been exciting for me to come back to the field and be able to participate in a program that assists individuals with disabilities in an empowering way and empowers them to get back to society. And I find that a lot of the testimony that's been shared already is true to myself also, that myself going through that can encourage others in that same way. So we have a great relationship with VR, Vocational Rehabilitation Office here, and also with programs such as Oregon School for the Deaf, the Commission for the Blind. And so we're seeing a lot of exciting things happening right now. Just in the last 6 months, we've had 10 individuals who we've placed in jobs some of them have come up with their 90 days and their VR files have been closed successfully, and some of them will be coming up to that time soon. So we're excited to partner with the community in that way. And additional funding would definitely be helpful. As you know, there's no Center for Independent Living here in Salem, so we do our best in our cubicle with the four of us to cover the six counties that we serve that do not have a full Center for Independent Living. So any additional funding for any of the services I can see is much needed and will be very valued.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Hello, Chair and representatives. My name is Missy Elder. I also work for Living Independently for Empowerment, which is attached to LILA in Eugene. I came on board totally clueless. I had onset of disabilities later in my life. I was not, you know, educated about them. I kind of did this whole struggle for several years. What do I do? How do I get reemployed? How do I manage my disabilities so I can continue good competitive employment? It took me a while. I started with the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services as a client. I had no idea there were centers for independent living. I happened to be presented with an opportunity for employment with the Center for Independent Living and have gained massive skills and experience for the last 3 years. It's been a joy to work with consumers with a variety of different disabilities and kind of learn how to work with them and adjust behavior, communication style, the way we work together, and just watch them come so maybe frustrated and helpless, hopeless, to watching them gain confidence and then skills to be able to go out there and apply for jobs and then land employment. That whole process is just rewarding for me to work with people like that. I've been exposed to so much. I am grateful to work for the Center for Independent Living, and it is very helpful. I will give a success story real quick. Last month, I lead the job readiness workshop where there's a group of VR clients that come in and gain experience in creating their employment portfolio, master application, resume, cover letters. I give them a mock interview and give them feedback so they get kind of some of that experience. Somebody got a job 2 days after the workshop. So we just love hearing success stories like that.
We do too.
And thank you. Please consider this bill.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming to testify. Thank you all for coming today. A lot of you chose not to testify. We know, obviously, that you're very invested in this issue. Thank you for coming, and thanks for your support. Yes, Representative Whitsitt.
I just have a comment. I would like to thank all of you brave people who came to testify today. And your stories are extremely profound, and we are all better for having heard them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well said.
Any further questions? Again, thank you all for coming. Thanks for the work that you do. Thanks for the clients who have come and obviously have progressed through these programs. It's very exciting. And I think we're going to be closing the hearing, but I think we would like to have a lot more information about this program. How many people are served, where the money goes, et cetera. When we see the staggering amount of money, it sort of takes our breath away. But obviously it's needed, it's used well, so hopefully we can work with you. Maybe we can work something out. Yeah. So thank you all for coming. Boy, you've made my day. Yes. Anything else from the committee?
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Thank you. With that, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2971, and we'll close the Human Services Committee. So thank you.